fast-tracking a secret trade agreement reeks of the stink of political corruption and corporate intimidation. I can't argue strongly enough what a terrible idea this is, and encourage people to contact your representatives in Congress to oppose the TPP.
You're listening to Food Integrity Now with your host, Carol Grevey.
Hello and welcome to Food Integrity Now. I'm Carol Grevey. I'm the host of the show. At Food Integrity Now, we envision a healthy, sustainable world. A world where our food is free from GMOs and harmful chemicals, where our food is healthy and safe for our children, our grandchildren, and generations to come. If you share our vision, please go to our website and join us by subscribing to us. And please don't forget to confirm your email. Hi, it's Carol again. Do you drink almond milk? Do you know that packaged almond milk contains all sort of nasty additives like carrageenan and barely contains any actual almonds? The good news is that you can make fresh almond milk at home in minutes. Once you taste the creamy, fresh flavor of homemade almond milk, you'll never go back. I make my almond milk at home with a Nutiana nut milk bag. It's great, easy to use, easy to clean, and makes my almond milk silky smooth. I make it 2 times a week, so I always have fresh almond milk in the fridge. The Nutiana nut milk bag is an essential tool for today's healthy kitchen. It's truly a multi-purpose bag, too. In addition to nut and seed milks, you can use it for sprouting, making cold brew coffee, juicing, and more. Buy yours today by searching the Nutiana nut milk bag on Amazon. That's Nutiana, nut milk bag. Or go to Nutiana.com. You're going to love this bag. My guest today is Jim Gerritsen. Jim owns and operates Wood Prairie Farm in Bridgewater, Maine, where his family grows certified organic and Maine certified seed potatoes. In March 2001, as president of the Organic Seed Growers and Trade Association, Jim filed a lawsuit against the Monsanto Corporation on behalf of 270,000 family farmers, gardeners, and consumers to challenge the validity of Monsanto's GE seed patents and to protect family farmers. In January 2014, the Supreme Court refused to hear Ascada et al. Versus Monsanto, letting stand the U.S. Court of Appeals ruling, which gave farmers a partial victory. Jim continues to challenge the use of GE crops and promotes GMO transparency and labeling for consumers. Today, we're going to be speaking with Jim about the challenges that are facing organic agriculture. I'm also interested in what Jim has to say about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the DARC Act. Jim, welcome back to Food Integrity Now.
Thank you, Carol. It's good to be here.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you on our show. And I would like you to share with your listeners, if you wouldn't mind this morning, just to kind of refresh their memory about who you are and your family farm.
Yes. Well, my wife, Megan, and I have an organic farm called Wood Prairie Farm in northern Maine. And we've been farming organically for almost 40 years. And the main crops that we raise are organic seed crops, of which organic seed potatoes is what we specialize in. And this part of northern Maine, as recently as 60 years ago, was the number one potato-producing spot in the United States. And we raise some of the best seed potatoes anywhere in North America. So that's what we focus on.
Great. Do you grow anything else there, Jim?
Yes. Like any organic farmer, we rotate our crops. So in addition, we grow organic grain as seed grain. We grow organic corn as seed corn. And we grow dry beans and some of the wet seeded crops as organic seed, things like peppers, squash, and tomato. These are crops that, even though we have a very short season in northern Maine, we can do a good job growing high-quality crop despite the short season.
Okay, great. And another thing, as I mentioned in my introduction of Jim, is he is the president of the Organic Seed Growers and Trade Association, otherwise known as OSCATA. And Jim, do you want to share with our listeners what happened with the lawsuit OSCATA et al. Versus Monsanto Corporation?
Yes. Well, Organic Seed Growers and Trade, one of the missions that we have is protecting organic seed. And we're organized so that we can aggressively protect that, meaning go into litigation. So we became the lead plaintiff in a major federal lawsuit that we filed just about 4 years ago in March of 2011. We filed this in federal district court in Manhattan, and we were seeking two remedies with this lawsuit. One is we were trying to gain court protection for farmers under the Declaratory Judgment Act that should we, through no fault of our own, become contaminated by Monsanto's patented technology, that we could not be accused of patent infringement against Monsanto's patents. That was one goal. The second goal is that after studying the matter, we came to be convinced that the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office had erred in granting Monsanto patents on their transgenic seed technology, and we were prepared to prove in court that those patents were both illegal and unconstitutional, and therefore invalid. So our attempt was to get to court to be able to argue our case, but immediately out of the starting gate, Monsanto challenged our ability to sue them in a challenge which is called standing, claiming that the farmers did not have a substantial controversy to bring this case forward. And the battle took about 3 years, and in the end, farmers gained a partial victory, but we were prevented from going to court and arguing our case as we had wanted to. And that's something that we're disappointed in, because we think that any American, particularly American farmers that are growing the food and fiber for this nation, that we should have access to the courts, especially when we want to defend ourselves from an aggressive patent bully like Monsanto. And we were denied that opportunity. So we're disappointed with that, but we are grateful to have this partial protection granted to us by the courts.
And so it's my understanding how that worked is the appeals court actually granted that, and then you tried to take the case to the I'm talking about granted that partial victory. And then when you went to the Supreme Court has lots of cases on its caseload, and they only hear a small percentage of those. And so you are not allowed to be heard at that Supreme Court level. So it defaulted back to the ruling under the appeals court. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit in Washington, D.C., did give us a partial victory. They repudiated the ruling of the district court judge in Manhattan, Judge Naomi Buchwald. Judge Buchwald had made the assertion that this was kind of a publicity stunt, that there was not any real case here. And the Court of Appeals contradicted that fairly dramatically. They said that contamination of the farmers, the reason we went to court, was inevitable. And it was a fairly complicated ruling, but in essence, they agreed that we had a case, that there was substantial controversy. But because they issued an estoppel, a judicial order, that very action of issuing the estoppel mooted our case, so they felt, because it gave us the protection they thought that we wanted. Well, the protection they gave us was imperfect and incomplete. And it's for that reason that we appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. The protection they granted us was this. They ordered Monsanto to hold to their word and the assurances that they would give on their website, saying that they would not go after farmers that had trace amounts of GE contamination on their farms. And the court defined trace amounts as 1% or less. But what's unclear is that if a farmer should have over 1% contamination, and that's very easy to have happen, there's no clarity that there's any protection at all for farmers. In addition, we had Canadians that were part of our lawsuit, because Canadians, in this case, sell into the United States, and they are covered by U.S. patent law. But the U.S. Supreme Court has no jurisdiction except over American soil. So if you're a Canadian farmer farming in Canada, that ruling, of course, has no bearing on Canadians. So there just was a lack of clarity. And what was disappointing to us is we could have gained this clarity had all of the justices agreed with our position that we had a right to be in court, that it was a substantial controversy, and we wanted the right to defend ourselves. And I can't think of any right that is more sacred in the United States than the right to self-defense, and we were denied that right. I do think that the three appeals court justices were attempting to be fair, but I think what would have been most fair is for us to have the right to go to court and to argue our case and let the case be judged on its merits.
Okay, Jim, so had you been granted that Supreme Court right, if your case would have been heard, what was the plan? What were you going to argue about?
Well, we had one of the best patent attorneys in the United States. His name is Dan Ravisher, and he's the executive director of the Public Patent Foundation in Manhattan. And Dan and his legal team had prepared four principal arguments based on patent law. One of the arguments that I'm familiar with was this. In 1820, Supreme Court Justice Story issued what has become a very famous opinion. And in this opinion, Justice Story said that should a person bring a poison to the patent office to be patented, that invention would not qualify for a patent because it lacked social utility. In other words, because it did not have social value, it did not meet the requirements of U.S. law and the U.S. Constitution. We were prepared to argue in court that Monsanto's genetically engineered patents did not meet that basic requirement of patents under U.S. law and the U.S. Constitution, in that genetically engineered crops do not provide social utility. They are void of that, and therefore Monsanto's patents were invalid. That was one of four arguments, and these arguments were self-standing, self-supporting. Had we won on a single one of the four arguments presented, we would have won our lawsuit. And I think we had very strong arguments. We had a very strong case, and I think that's why Monsanto worked so hard to prevent this case from ever getting to court. In addition, Monsanto was very, very much opposed to the discovery process in which our attorneys would have had access to their internal files. So we knew that they were going to fight tooth and nail to keep us out of court. And unfortunately, in that way, they succeeded. So we had to be content with this minor victory. But ultimately, we were unhappy that we were not given our right to access to the courts.
Yeah, I bet Monsanto would spend their last dime trying not to get their internal documents exposed.
I think that's an accurate statement.
Yeah. Okay, so in this whole process, you learned about something called the Public Trust Doctrine. Can you let our listeners know what this doctrine is all about?
Yes, the public trust doctrine is something that actually goes back to Roman times, and it in fact was a basic part of U.S. law through the latter part of the 19th century. What the public trust doctrine articulates is that government simply does not possess the authority to privatize the commons. And the commons is what is jointly owned by everyone. The air that we breathe, the water that flows through the rivers, things like that are generally recognized as the commons. It's owned commonly by all of humankind. And many of us feel that seed also fits that definition, in that we have been practicing agriculture for 10,000 years from the time that our ancestors stopped being hunter-gatherers and became, localized in an area and started to grow crops in soil. So the development of seed, first they took wild grasses and through a process of selection, developed these crops into the basic staple crops upon which human life on the planet now exists. So for 10,000 years, the control of seed was within our ancestors, within a farming community, because back not very long ago, most everyone farmed. And so the idea that that something like seed or that water or that air can be privatized is really a new and an amazing concept, which many of us think violates the public trust doctrine. So I can give you an example where one might where it might illustrate this. Imagine if a corporation wanted to move into a community and their factory made a product, but the downside was that the product would pollute the water in the process of making that product. So then the government might feel that because of the jobs and the benefits available, that it would be an advantage to let this corporation come in, and they might sell to them basically a permit which for a certain amount of money gives them the right to pollute the water. Well, if you're living downstream of that water and rely upon that for your community's water supply, that doesn't seem like a good deal. And so the public trust doctrine is saying that that government, in issuing that permit allowing a corporation to pollute the water, acted beyond its authority, that it does not have the authority to sell or privatize the commons. Another example of that would be when it refers to seed. The granting of a monopoly or the granting of a patent is essentially a government-authorized monopoly. So when the Supreme Court in the 1980s, for the first time in U.S. history, allowed seed to be patented, this amounted to a privatization of seed, which was in the commons, and many of us feel that the Supreme Court overstepped its authority when, in fact, it does not have the authority to privatize, to take from the commons and to give to private corporations, which is exactly what has happened with the patenting of seed. And, of course, in the 1980s, this was the rise of the chemical companies that reinvented themselves as biotech companies, chief among them Monsanto. They started buying up in the 1990s formerly independent and family-held seed companies, and through those purchases, they gained monopoly control of the seed supply, and our U.S. Department of Justice Antitrust Division was asleep at the wheel as these companies were being purchased, and that's the situation where we find ourselves today. Multinational chemical companies reinvented as biotech companies now control an alarming amount of the seed in the world, and many of us feel that these patents are invalid because they violate the public trust doctrine.
Okay. And if people want to find out more about this public trust doctrine, where can they learn more about this?
Well, there's been one of the most important books in the last couple of decades was written by Dr. Mary Wood, and the title of the book is Nature's Trust, and it goes into great detail. It's a very readable book, and it goes into great detail describing the concept of the public trust doctrine and how this is really going to be a new, invigorated way of looking at environmental problems in society today, that we have to protect the commons because it belongs to all of us, and that when the government does not discipline itself and remain consistent to the public trust doctrine, they need to be challenged on that. And I think that it offers hope that if we can get back to using the public trust doctrine as part of the basis of our jurisprudence in this country, that will be the better for it. And in fact, this English common law is based on this concept of the commons and protection of the commons, and this goes back to the Magna Carta, and these are basic principles upon which our legal system is founded.
Thank you for that, Jim. And I think our listeners would be interested in knowing a little bit more about the patent process and how that works. Can you share that with us?
Yes, you bet. Patents are as old as our country is. And what a patent boils down to is that it is a government-sanctioned monopoly on a concept or an invention. It can be granted to individuals. It can be granted to entities. It has some limited duration. I think most patents last for 18 years. But here's what it boils down to. Every Tuesday, approximately 4,500 patents are granted by the U.S. and Patent and Trademark Office in Washington, D.C. And what that boils down to is that 4,500 more things that Americans are prevented from doing. So if you take that over the course of the year, almost 200 patents are applied for and approved by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. In the patent community, only a patent is only considered valid if it has been challenged in court and upheld as valid. Well, as you might imagine, this is a costly process to challenge a patent. And for that matter, for that reason, not that many are challenged. In the course of a year, of those 200,000 patents that are granted, only approximately 4,000 to 5,000 patents are challenged every year. What is astounding, though, is the percentage of patents granted by the U.S. Patent Office that are found to be invalid. And I think it helps maybe in understanding why this would be so, to understand that the U.S. Patent Office makes money every time they approve a patent. But in the course of the 4,000 to 5,000court cases which challenge patents every year, 50%, half of all patents are found invalid. If you then take that percentage over to the 200,000 patents that are issued annually, half or about 100,000 of those patents are invalid. So when we took our case to court, statistically, even if it weren't for the merits of our case, statistically, we had a very good chance of winning our case. And again, I felt that in Oscada et al. V. Monsanto, we had a particularly strong case, that had we been given our right to present that case in court, we did have confidence that we were going to be victorious.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that the patents usually expired in 18 years. That's like an average, or is that just...
Yeah, I'm a farmer and not a patent attorney,
okay.
But that's my understanding is that most patents are for 18 years.
Okay.
And then typically what happens after 18 years is that a corporation like Monsanto will make a minor tweak in that, and then they'll get a brand new patent for something that is substantially the same as what the old patent was for. But that's how it, how the game is played. The patent system has been, in modern times, strongly influenced by the corporations of this country, and it is a system that I would say, when you have half of all patents being granted invalid, I would say that we have fast approached a dysfunctional system, to where the reality is it is not serving the people, but it is serving the corporations instead.
Well, like so many of our government agencies, but we don't need to go into all that right now. Okay, so that's great. I think I have a more clear understanding of the process and how we've gotten to where we are right now. So what do you see the future of organic? So this 1% contamination, and that can happen easily to go above that amount because of drift and what else?
Well, the fact is genetic engineering is invisible. You could have a contaminated seed lot and not know it. The only way you can find out is to send a seed lot off to a laboratory and have it laboratory tested for GMO content. And that's what we as organic seed growers do. That's within Organic Seed Growers and Trade Association. That's a common practice for organic seed growers to send at-risk seed lots off to a trusted laboratory and have them perform a test. And the standard test is a 10,000 kernel test. And PCR testing is the state-of-the-art test that we recommend, and detectability is one kernel out of 10,000, which is a 0.01% detectable limit. That means that if you submit a representative sample of 10,000 kernels, they can detect a single kernel out of that 10,000 kernels. And in our case, we have a very isolated farm in Maine, and seed corn is one of the major crops that we grow. And every year we have our different lots of organic seed corn tested. Because of our isolation, we have never had contamination on our farm. But this is far different in isolated northern Maine, almost north of where corn is practical to grow. Compare that with the Midwest or larger states like New York and Pennsylvania, where a great deal of corn is grown in the same proximity of where organic farms are. And that is where the problem comes in, where you have organic crops being grown in geographic proximity of GMO crops. That's where, if you have a common pollination period, that's where you have a high risk of contamination, is when the pollen from Monsanto's corn blows off of their field, crosses the fence onto the farm of an organic farmer, and that genetically engineered pollen then contaminates the organic crop. And in the case of organic seed, the market will not accept genetically engineered contaminated organic seed, so contamination extinguishes the value of that organic seed. And we think that the federal government should have, if they're going to allow biotech companies to release these crops, they should have required them to contain their pollution to not harm the commons as a prerequisite for their ability to allow farmers to grow their seed. It's not been done. There is no limitation. There is full deregulation, and the federal government is looking the other way and inventing fallacious concepts like coexistence between organic and genetically engineered crops. Another fallacious concept is this substantial equivalence, which Monsanto lobbyist Stephen Taylor and Vice President Dan Quayle in 1992 concocted, and it's a completely unscientific standard. It was a political decision that claims that genetically engineered crops and their traditional counterparts are substantially equivalent because they look like they're about the same. It's a ludicrous standard. It has no scientific basis at all. And now, as increased study occurs, we're finding that, in fact, genetically engineered crops pose a significant problem for human health, livestock health, and the environment.
Well, they masterminded that quite effectively in the early 90s. It's my understanding that that was kind of the era of deregulation, you know, right after Reagan was president, and, you know, there was a lot of regulations, and so the big word was deregulation. They came up with this substantial equivalency as part of the, you know, Regulatory Relief Act, which people in general were hearing, well, this is good, less regulations, but they squeezed that in there so that there was no testing done, and the substantial equivalency part was granted.
Yes, I think this narrative that deregulation is a good idea is part of the propaganda that has been brought to us, bought and paid for by American corporations that have no problem with limiting the public interest, with stealing from the commons, and creating basically the American people as second-class citizens that have to follow the dictates of what the corporate elite desire. And this is not how a democracy is supposed to run. This is not where we send our sons and daughters to war to defend the interests of the United States and to have the public interest subjected to control by corporations for their own private material gains. And, you know, this is a dilemma that we're seeing across the political spectrum now of corporate control of the economy, of the society, of the media, and this idea that deregulation is the panacea when, in fact, it is simply subjugating the public interest. And that is a large part of the problem that we're experiencing in our country today.
Yeah, well said, Jim. So I'd like to ask you a question, and maybe you could clear this up for our listeners. The difference between hybridization and open pollination and genetic engineering.
Open pollination is where you're taking very close, closely related plants, and you get, when you grow them out, and the crops that we grow on our organic seed farm are all open pollinated. The harvest comes back true, meaning that if you then plant the seed that you harvest, it will come back the same as what you planted the previous spring. Hybrids are taking fairly closely aligned families. You might have a member, say, of the broccoli family and the closely related cabbage family, and you, in a specific pattern, you do cross-breeding between those two closely aligned members of very close families, and you come up with what's called an F1 hybrid, which, if you plant the seed taken from an F1 hybrid, it will not come back true. And within organic seed, within the organic seed community, primarily you have open pollinated varieties, and many of us, myself included, believe that that is superior because it allows us to gain local adaptation through selection. We can come up with improved qualities that fit in our area. For example, I had a friend in Michigan raising organic corn and saving his own seed, and in 5 years, simply through selection, he had reduced the number of days growth from 120 days down to 90 days. He had shaved off a quarter of that length of time for growing simply through selection in five generations. I should add, though, there are legitimate forms of hybrid seed production which do meet every traditional standard of organic farming, and those can be found within the organic seed community. These two techniques, open-pollinated OP and hybrids, stand in stark contrast to the different types of genetic engineering. The most common type of genetic engineering to date is called transgenic, and that refers to taking a gene from one species and gene splicing it with a gene gun in a laboratory to an entirely different species. For example, they took the a gene from the a flounder, a certain type of fish, and they gene spliced that into a strawberry with the intention of increasing the frost resistance of that strawberry. Well, obviously, a strawberry in the plant kingdom and a flounder, a fish, in the animal kingdom would never, ever be a cross that would occur in nature. So genetic engineering is inherently unnatural because it is taking genes of completely dissimilar species and combining together for some corporate envisioned improvement. And I think the important thing to always remember about genetic engineering is that the primary reason for genetic engineering is control. It is control that the biotech companies want. It is control which brought the biotech companies into agriculture and into the seed industry. They want to control the seed, and in the licensing agreements that the biotech companies require farmers to sign when they grow their biotech seed, it requires farmers to buy new seed from the biotech company each and every year. It does not allow that farmer to save seed. And this saving of seed is a tradition that goes back for hundreds of generations. For 10,000 years, farmers have controlled the seed. It has been in the commons. And now that biotech has come along and patented seed and added their chemical death technology to the seed culture, this has completely changed the face of agriculture, and essentially it is about control. Who controls the seed controls the food. Who controls the food controls the people.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly. Thank you for that explanation. I think that was very clear, and I know I hear a lot of the GMO proponents talking about that this genetic engineering has been going on for hundreds of years, and that is just a lie.
Bald-faced lying. It is part of a very sophisticated propaganda campaign trying to make us believe that their new technology is something that's been going on for a very long time, and that's completely false. Genetic engineering is a laboratory technique that could never be performed on the farm, and it's just one of the many lies that we hear every day from biotech.
Right. So, Jim, we only have about 5 more minutes, so I wanted to get your take on two subjects. One is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, otherwise known as the TPP. Part of the problem, and then there are many issues with the TPP, but a lot of people believe that there's going to be a backdoor entry for genetically modified seeds and crops to be in countries, you know, that currently have a ban on them or that require labeling. What are your thoughts, just in general, on what the TPP might do to our food safety?
Well, TPP stands for Trans-Pacific Partnership, and it is a trade agreement which is absolutely undemocratic. First off, many of the provisions of TPP are secret. They're hidden from the people. How can we possibly, in a democratic system, support a trade agreement in which we don't know what the content of the trade agreement is? It is widely believed that the biotech industry is one of the forces pushing TPP. And my understanding is that this will supersede national legislation. So a country's sovereignty is going to be challenged here if a country's laws do not meet the requirements of the secret content of the TPP, then they are going to be ruled invalid. And this is absolutely illegitimate in terms of a democracy. The people's right must always be the paramount factor in developing policy. And for corporations to put pressure upon the government for a transnational form of allegiance to an agreement that the people can't even find out about because it's secret, it's absolutely abhorrent. This is something that the Congress needs to vote down immediately, and it is rumored that there is an ability to force genetically engineered crops into countries where these countries have taken the courageous stand of, say, requiring labeling the crops, or actually there are some countries that are investigating actually banning genetically engineered crops, and it would take away their sovereignty and their ability to choose their own fate and their own determination, and that is entirely anti-democratic, and for that reason this TPP needs to be defeated.
Yeah, and right now they're trying to fast track it, which means that, you know, it could get approved in a much quicker period of time, and that makes a lot of sense for the proponents who are for this, the multinational corporations, because they do not want this information to get out to the public.
Fast-tracking a secret trade agreement reeks of the stink of political corruption and corporate intimidation.
Yeah.
I can't argue strongly enough what a terrible idea this is, and encourage people to contact your representatives in Congress to oppose the TPP.
Yeah, exactly. And for our listeners, if you're on Facebook, you know, go to GMO Free USA or other Food Integrity Now has posted about this. There are petitions. You know, you can write your congresswoman or congressman about it, but this is not a good thing. So thank you for that, Jim. And my last question is about the DARK Act. And the DARK Act is essentially the Pompeo bill, which in essence, if passed, would take away state labeling. And in essence, it's my understanding that it would make genetically modified ingredients, it would go to not a mandatory labeling, but a voluntary labeling. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, that's my understanding as well. The effort is to try to preempt the right of states like our state of Maine, where we passed the second GMO labeling law in the United States, Connecticut, which passed the first GMO labeling law in the United States, Vermont, which passed the third GMO labeling law in the United States. It would preempt states like ours that whose citizens felt that we deserve the right to know about genetically engineered food. It would remove from us our ability to have sovereignty in our own state over that. And again, these are anti-democratic efforts. What is interesting is that the Pompeo bill is supported by folks that generally don't like the federal government having any control, but they practice hypocrisy in this idea of denying state rights when it comes to genetically engineered. And it comes as no surprise that Monsanto was one of the forces behind the Pompeo bill. And this is an effort to deny people their right to know. It is, in a democracy, transparency is the lifeblood of how the system should work. People have a right to know whether the food that they the food choice before them is genetically engineered or not. And in a free democracy and in a free market, people decide through knowledge how they're going to spend their dollars. For them to deny that transparency, to cloak it so that people can't possibly find out, is completely unacceptable. Mandatory labeling, the mandatory act to require right-to-know labeling so citizens can determine how to spend their money, that is what is acceptable and needed in a democracy. To deny that is illegitimate, and we can expect that that there is a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuvering now to substitute what Maine and the other states have passed as mandatory GMO labeling for this idea of voluntary labeling. I mean, we have the ability right now, if a company wants to voluntarily label, they can voluntarily label. This is not creating anything new except preempting states from passing right-to-know laws that their citizens deem wise for their locale. This is how democracy is supposed to work. We're supposed to come to our own decisions within the areas like the state of Maine, how we want things done here, and we don't need the federal government telling us that this is not appropriate for Maine. This is entirely unacceptable, and the DARK Act is another one supported by Monsanto, another bill that needs to be defeated.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Jim. And if anybody listened to the hearing on the DARK Act, which I think was in November, you can find that on YouTube, Google DARK Act hearing or use words like that and you will find it. I was just incredulous because the representative, I can't think of his name right now, from the FDA was questioned by several representatives. And in my opinion, he absolutely perjured himself. He was asked questions like, are you aware of any study showing harm from genetically engineered food? And he said not to his knowledge. And that is just a lie. So again, I tell our listeners, use your voice, contact your congressperson and tell them your thoughts on this, because unless we use our voices, these things are going to pass. Thank you, Jim, for being a guest on our show, and I appreciate all your great information. I certainly learned some things about the patent process, and anxious to get that book that you spoke about, Nature's Trust. And again, we'll post that, a link to that, as well as a link to Jim's farm, which looks amazing, on our website. So thank you, Jim, and we look forward to following you. You're on Facebook as well. You want to give your information for our listeners?
Yes, we have two Facebook walls. One is Wood Prairie Farm, and the other is simply Jim Garretson. And we use that as kind of a daily news feed, bringing to our community the attention of news and information about how good organic farming is, how bad genetic engineering and chemical agriculture based on toxic chemicals. And people, we love to have them visit us. We also have a newsletter we send out every couple of weeks, an e-newsletter called The Seed Piece that we've been producing now for, I think, 20 years. And that's available for a free subscription if you go to our website, www.woodprairie.com. You can sign up, and we'd love to send it to you.
Okay, great. I get that newsletter, and I highly recommend it. So thank you, Jim, for being a guest on our show, and we will be back next week with another great show.